Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Welcome to the EPA Playbook Series, where we break down entrustable professional activities in surgery through practical cases, clinical reasoning, and real-world application. So whether you're preparing for the OR, the clinic, call, or consults, these episodes are designed to support your growth one EPA at a time.
And we're releasing five of these episodes in podcast form, so they'll be wherever you access your BTK content normally. But the remaining 13 EPA episodes can be found on behindtheknife.org and our app. To access all of our series episodes, including additional outlines, transcripts, and useful images, simply create a free account on the website or app. Once you're registered, the entire course will appear in your library at no cost. So let's get started and get ready to dominate EPAs.
Our EPA series is brought to you by Open Evidence. A majority of practicing U.S. physicians already use it to pull trusted, evidence-based answers from the medical literature in seconds, right at the point of care. At Behind the Knife, we are about surgical education and lifelong learning, and Open Evidence fits how we already work. We're glad to be partnering with them for the surgical community.
Hi, all you BTK fans. It's Scott here, and welcome back to the EPA Playbook, the podcast where we dig into the entrustable professional activities that shape surgical training. So with me today are two of our BTK surgical education fellows, Agnes Premkumar from Creighton and Emma Burke from Baylor. So today we're going to delve a little bit into the benign and malignant colon EPA. Now, this activity requires us to handle everything from elective cancer staging to emergent resections for perforation or obstruction.
To recap, EPAs matter because they translate the abstract language of competencies into the real work you do every day as a surgical resident. Each EPA defines a professional activity you must eventually be trusted to perform independently. EPAs may also make feedback more meaningful by increasing objectivity and providing more data points across time, specialty, case type, and case complexity. When you demonstrate consistent entrustment on EPAs, it accelerates your progression toward independent operating and decision-making. And that's why we've created this series. It's the perfect way for junior residents to dominate EPAs.
So let's frame this entire topic with a scenario. So Mr. C is a 65-year-old man who was referred to the clinic after a screening colonoscopy unfortunately revealed a biopsy-proven adenocarcinoma of the sigmoid colon. He was asymptomatic. He does have a 40-pack year history of smoking. He's got well-controlled hypertension. So what's the initial plan for his malignancy, and what does this workup entail?
The first priority here is to get a complete oncologic staging. That includes getting a CT chest, abdomen, pelvis with contrast to evaluate for metastatic disease. And you want to review the colonoscopy report to confirm where exactly the tumor is, if they placed a tattoo there, and any other synchronous lesions. In addition, it's important to note on the colonoscopy if the lesion is obstructing or if the endoscopist was able to get past the lesion and evaluate the colon fully. Be sure to get also a baseline CA, which can help us in keeping track of his response to therapy and recurrence.
But before we get too ahead of ourselves, we should get a good history and physical exam. It's important to ask questions about weight loss, blood in the stool, and anemia-related symptoms. We also want to discuss his bowel movements. We want to make sure that he's not clinically obstructed, which might warrant a more urgent intervention. Also, be sure to ask about family history of colorectal cancer, polyposis syndromes, or IBD. All of these will change his cancer risk and subsequently the type of surgery that we will have to think about and offer.
And specifically for colorectal surgery, it's important to understand what his baseline continence is, since some of our procedures, such as an LAR, can impact this. And also, just like any other patient, you want to understand his prior surgeries, medical comorbidities, and his overall functional status to see if he's able to undertake and recover from a cancer operation.
And just to jump in here, I would also ask him about any prior use of biologics or steroids that might interfere with wound healing, especially in those patients who have a history of IBD.
That was comprehensive. Great job. So what are you looking for in physical exam?
Yeah, I want to do a focused but complete exam. That means looking at doing a good abdominal exam for masses or distension and also a rectal exam to rule out any distal disease and evaluate his sphincter function, and also palpate his inguinal nodal basins to see if he might have any bulky nodes there.
So the patient tells you that he's been feeling good overall, no bloody bowel movements or recent changes in bowel habits. This was his first colonoscopy. He has no other medical comorbidities, no family history of colon or rectal cancer, and only a vague discomfort in the left abdomen at times that resolves spontaneously. His abdomen is soft on examination, it's non-tender, and you cannot palpate any nodal disease in his inguinal basins. When you review his colonoscopy, it shows that he has a 4-centimeter fungating mass in the sigmoid colon that was positive for adenocarcinoma. They did MSI testing on it, and it was MSI low. The GI team has tattooed the location as well. They were able to get the cecum, and no other lesions were identified. Baseline CEA is elevated at 5, and imaging does not reveal any other synchronous tumors or metastatic deposits. What is this stage, and how do we do neoadjuvant therapy or go straight into surgery?
So staging in colon cancer is dependent on the extent of tumor invasion and lymph node involvement. The tumor is graded on depth of invasion. TIS is carcinoma in situ, where the lamina propria is the only layer involved. T1 invades the submucosa, T2 invades the muscularis propria, and T3 invades through the muscularis propria to the pericolorectal tissues, while T4 invades the visceral peritoneum and even can adhere to adjacent organs. So our end stage depends on lymph node number, with N0 being no lymph node involvement, N1 being 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes, and N2 is 4 or more positive lymph nodes. And then for our M component, it's a 1 if there is a metastasis to a distal site or if you have peritoneal metastases. And unlike rectal cancer, colon cancer does not usually get neoadjuvant therapy for early stage cancers. If the tumor is locally advanced, such as a T3 or 4 with positive nodes, or has high risk features like the mismatch repair deficient tumors, so MSI high, patients might benefit from neoadjuvant therapy to downstage the tumor and improve your resection margins. This includes an emerging body of literature that has demonstrated improved outcomes for neoadjuvant immunotherapy for MSI high tumors. As a recap, microsatellite instability is where cancer cells have many DNA errors because their DNA repair system, MMR or mismatch repair, is not working correctly. That leads to unstable, short, repeating DNA sequences, and the instability makes tumor cells prone to accumulating even more mutations. This is also the basis of hereditary syndromes such as Lynch syndrome. That instability makes these cells good candidates for immunotherapy or chemotherapy based on specific mutation-targeted approaches. Our patient here doesn't seem to have any high-risk features, so we can schedule surgery.
Preoperative optimization for these patients is similar to other surgeries. You want to advocate for things like smoking cessation and doing a good cardiac risk stratification. Another important component is nutritional assessment. We want to see if our cancer patients are tolerating their food currently, and will they be able to deal with the insult of surgery. Be sure to also think about getting an albumin level and examine for physical signs of cachexia like temporal wasting.
So our patient is well nourished, has no signs of a cachexia, and he does not smoke and has had no issues with his heart. He really overall seems ready for surgery. But before we go into surgery, another important thing to discuss here is the preoperative planning stage, and that's ERAS, or Enhanced Recovery After Surgery, which truly was kind of pioneered in colorectal surgery. So, Emma, what is it, and how does it apply for our patient here?
The ERAS pathway is designed to help improve recovery by optimizing care before, during, and after surgery, and is truly something that, especially as an intern, you're going to really get a good handle on for your patients. The first guideline was published all the way back in 2005, and the main goals were to emphasize nutrition, minimally invasive procedures as possible, early mobilization, and pain control using techniques such as regional anesthesia. The benefits are a reduced hospital length of stay and a faster return to normal function for the patient. I would talk to our patient about this protocol in the office so that he's aware of the plan to encourage regional anesthesia, such as a tap block or spinal anesthesia, ambulating as soon as possible post-surgery, and then resuming his normal diet as soon as possible.
And I can't emphasize that enough. What you're trying to do here is manage expectations to a certain degree. So what are some of the other important things to mention during the consenting process, and specifically for colorectal cancer surgery?
Consent should include a discussion of the performance of an oncologic resection, and that includes a lymphadenectomy so that we can get adequate staging information. And as always, we should mention that we'll start with a minimally invasive approach, but we might need to convert to open if that's what's safer for the patient. However, the trickier thing to discuss is the potential need for an ostomy creation. The nuances of ostomy creation will depend on the nature of the dissection, how stuck or inflamed the mass in the surrounding colon is, and how the tension looks on the two ends of the resected colon that we are going to try to sew back together. We'll also need to consider if the patient can heal an anastomosis, or if it's better to do a diverting ostomy and then later take that down. Sometimes we'll do a diverting ostomy if we're concerned that the patient will develop an anastomotic leak, and this diverting ostomy will help reduce the risk of pelvic sepsis.
And other complications that you should mention are bleeding, ureteral injury, anastomotic leaks, and sexual or urinary dysfunction, because we're dissecting really in the pelvic region.
So as a recap, Mr. C has a 4-centimeter sigmoid adenocarcinoma with no identifiable notable metastases or metastatic disease on imaging, and he has no MSI high features. So what operation do you want to offer?
Okay, so we have a lot of options here for a good oncologic resection. We can either do an open or a minimally invasive based approach, since he's had a small tumor that doesn't really have any invasion of surrounding areas. I would advocate that we would start with a minimally invasive approach for a sigmoid colectomy with a primary anastomosis and a flexible sigmoidoscopy if we have any difficulty locating the tumor. And if we have any difficulty performing a tension-free anastomosis, we can really resort to that ostomy.
Yeah, and in the OR, we want to ensure proper positioning, often lithotomy with arms tucked to facilitate flex sig. And as always, we want to ensure safe abdominal access through thoughtful port placement. We always want to be sure to confirm the ureter location before we fire the stapler to resect. And remember, the ureters lie on the psoas muscle and cross medial to the gonadal vessels. Many surgeons often involve their urology colleagues to assist with placement of ureteral stents so that they can help avoid injuring the ureter.
So those are great things to keep in mind. What are the required margins and lymph nodes?
We need at least 12 lymph nodes for an adequate lymph node harvest, and the resection should be an end block removal with 5-centimeter margins, both proximally and distally. Make sure you see where the tumor is localized before you do a resection. The tattoos that they do during colonoscopy can help identify, but there is any difficulty or if you're unsure about where it is, you can always perform a flexible sigmoidoscopy intraoperatively to confirm where your tumor is.
And I can't emphasize that last point, is that understanding where the tattoo is in orientation to the lesion itself. By nature, we tend to always tattoo distal to those lesions, but you never know who the gastroenterology colleague might do. And sometimes they tattoo it proximal and distal, or you can only see one tattoo, and the report says there are two of them. So use that flexible sigmoidoscopy as needed to, again, identify the location. So do we always need to mobilize the splenic flexure for a sigmoid colon cancer?
Not necessarily. It's optional and really depends on how much tension you have on your anastomosis. If the tumor is in the proximal sigmoid colon or if the patient has a foreshortened colon, too much tension on the anastomosis will increase your risk for a leak. Mobilizing the colon at the splenic flexure can help with more length to ensure that tension-free anastomosis. Again, a good anastomosis should be tension-free, properly aligned, and well-perfused. We should ensure that there's not twisting of the mesentery and that the color of the colon looks good. You can even use things such as immunofluorescence to check the blood supply. An examination with leak testing, where you provide air through the scope, is the standard of care for left-sided resections.
Yeah, we talk about ICG being one test, but I like ICB. I see bleeding edges on the cut edge of the bowel itself.
A quick word about our partner, Open Evidence. One of the most challenging parts of modern surgery is trying to stay current on clinical literature while balancing a full clinical schedule. Open Evidence helps me quickly find trusted, evidence-based answers from the medical literature with direct citations, which I've used for reviewing evidence before clinic, prepping for a complex case, answering a tough question on rounds, and building a teaching conference or getting ready for an M&M presentation. The majority of U.S. physicians already use it. From trainees studying for boards to attendings working through hard clinical questions, it makes the latest evidence easier to find and apply when it counts. Learn more at openevidence.com.
So we touched on this earlier, but when do you divert?
Yeah, so consider diverting if the patient has poor tissue quality, if they're just having ongoing hemodynamic instability, or if you feel that the patient is a high risk for healing an anastomosis. They might be on steroids or be malnourished. Or if you're just worried about the perfusion of your anastomosis, think about diverting.
Great. So let's go back to our case. Mr. C's surgery thankfully went well, and you completed a laparoscopic sigmoid colectomy and a primary anastomosis. You got the path back and revealed a 4.2-centimeter adenocarcinoma that invaded the muscularis propria. So he was a pathologic T2N0M0 with no lymphovascular invasion. What are our postoperative priorities?
So again, we're going to go back to that ERAS protocol. Early mobilization, early feeding, and multimodal pain management with things like Tylenol, NSAIDs, minimal narcotics, the use of gabapentinoids, and local and regional anesthesia. We'll also need a surveillance plan for his malignancy, which will include coordinating with oncology. This patient had a complete colonoscopy prior to surgery, so he needs his next one at a year after surgery. And if that colonoscopy looks good, then he can come back 3 years later and then 5 years subsequently. Let's say that the patient had an obstructive cancer that was not able to be traversed preoperatively, so we wouldn't have screened the rest of his colon before the surgery. You'll want to get a colonoscopy 3 to 6 months after surgery to rule out any synchronous cancers, which are two or more colon cancers existing at the same time.
Okay, let's take us back and say that Mr. C is now on post-op day five. He was doing great and almost ready for discharge, but suddenly got fever, tachycardia, and new onset oliguria. What are you worried about?
Okay, so these symptoms, along with the time frame of him being on postoperative day five, immediately makes me suspicious for an anastomotic leak or maybe an intra-abdominal abscess. I want to make sure that he has fluids running, antibiotics running, and then get an urgent CT scan, which will really evaluate the anastomosis. You can get a CT scan with a rectal contrast as well. If there are fluid collections, but they're relatively small, you could consider getting a percutaneous drain by IR to control the leak. But if he has a leak that's significant and he's clinically not doing well, he might have to go back to the OR for source control and maybe even a diverting ostomy.
Great. So a colon cancer management is built on strong preoperative staging and good oncological resection and anastomosis. And to be sure to counsel the patient on their postoperative surveillance. Let's shift gears now to another patient scenario. Mr. L is a 62-year-old man who presents to the emergency department with 2 days of progressively worsening left lower quadrant abdominal pain. He describes it as constant, dull, and worse with movement. He's had subjective fevers, decreased appetite, and mild nausea, but no vomiting. He also reports constipation for the last 3 days, but doesn't have melena and no hematochezia. He's had no prior abdominal surgeries, and his last colonoscopy was 8 years ago and reportedly showed diverticulosis. What's our differential based on his history?
So some diagnoses I'd want to consider would be ischemic colitis, infectious colitis, IBD, nephrolithiasis, a UTI or pyelonephritis, and a colonic malignancy. In women, too, we can add on some gynecologic causes, such as ovarian torsion, a ruptured ovarian cyst, or pelvic inflammatory disease. And I'd want to get a good exam and take a look at his imaging and labs to kind of narrow down that list.
So on exam, first his vitals, he's febrile, the 38.3, his heart rate is 102, and his blood pressure is stable. On his abdominal exam, it's notable for localized tenderness in the left lower quadrant with mild guarding, but again, no diffuse peritonitis. He got his labs back and it's significant for a white blood cell count of 14.5. That's mildly left shifted. He's got a mildly elevated CRP and his lactate is normal. He did get a CT scan and it shows segmental sigmoid colon wall thickening with pericolic fat stranding, several diverticula, 2.5 centimeter pericolic fluid collection, consistent with a small abscess and no free air. What's running through your mind now?
It seems to me like this is a diverticulitis flare. Diverticulitis is an infection of diverticula in the colon wall. And uncomplicated diverticulitis is when the inflammation is just localized to the colon wall, while complicated diverticulitis is when there's abscesses, fistulas, or obstructions from like a stricture, and perforations as a consequence of the diverticulitis. So in our patient, this is complicated diverticulitis because he has an abscess. The main way really to talk about diverticulitis is with a Hinchey classification. Hinchey 1A is pericolic inflammation or phlegmon, where 1B is pericolic or mesenteric abscess, and Hinchey 2 is when you have pelvic, intraabdominal, or retroperitoneal abscess. Then Hinchey 3 is purulent peritonitis, which is free pus but no fecal contamination. And then Hinchey 4 is really feculent peritonitis, where you have gross stool spillage. Our patient has a small pericolic abscess, so he's now at a Hinchey 1B.
And oftentimes this matters because Hinchey 1 and Hinchey 2 are usually non-operative, whereas Hinchey 3 and Hinchey 4 are often surgical emergencies. So what are the treatment modalities, Emma, and what will you offer our patient?
So for Hinchey 1, we typically recommend IV antibiotics that are broad spectrum with some bowel rest and posterior abdominal exams. Abscesses less than 3 to 4 centimeters are usually treated with antibiotics alone. For a patient with Hinchey 2 diverticulitis, so an abscess greater than 3 or 4 centimeters, we'd recommend percutaneous drainage, IV antibiotics, and close observation. And then lastly, for Hinchey 3 and 4, we'd recommend an operation. So for our patient, I want to start him on some ceftriaxone and Flagyl and give him some bowel rest.
Okay, so let's say that Mr. C is not really progressing with bowel rest. In fact, 4 days later, his abdominal exam seems to be getting worse and he's more symptomatic.
Yeah, I'm worried that his diverticulitis is not responding and that he's just progressing. So if he's stable, I would rescan him to see if he's developed more abscesses. But if he's peritonitic or unstable, I would counsel him on proceeding to the operating room for a washout, sigmoid resection, and a possible Hartmann's procedure. Remember, the indications for an emergent operation is if he's peritonitic, if he has a free perforation, septic shock, and like our patient, if he fails non-operative management.
So let's just say he is peritonitic and you decide to take him to the operating room. Historically, operative diverticulitis meant Hartmann's procedure with a sigmoid colectomy, which is an end colostomy in the Hartmann stump. But nowadays, it seems like it's a little bit more nuanced. So walk us through some of the operative options available now.
Yeah, so for our patient, once he's in the operating room, depending on the tissue quality and his clinical stability, we can perform either a primary resection with an anastomosis, with or without a diverting ileostomy. A Hartmann's procedure is more like a damage control surgery involving that resection of the diseased colon and getting that ostomy made to get out of there quickly. Key here is that there's no anastomosis in the Hartmann's. You leave behind that Hartmann stump and create an end colostomy.
And during the colectomy, the resection should be carried out to healthy colon proximally and distally. And these are really your margins, so different from a cancer operation. You also want to wash out liberally and make sure that you evaluate that rectal stump to make sure that tissue quality is healthy and will heal. If the colonic ends are well perfused, the patient is stable, and he doesn't have a history of steroid use or immunosuppression that you're worried about, it's reasonable to perform an anastomosis.
So let's just say that you have considerable difficulty in dissecting out the sigmoid. You're able to resect the diseased portion, but despite your best efforts, in the proximal and distal ends of the colon do not appear to be the healthiest. So you decide to do a Hartmann's. What do you need to do postoperatively?
So postoperatively, I'd continue his antibiotics for 4 more days from surgery, as he has had source control at that time of surgery. And that's all based on the stoppage trial. And now that he has an ostomy, I'd recommend closely monitoring the output to ensure that he doesn't get dehydrated. But this is typically more common with an ileostomy. You can resume a diet once he has return of bowel function. And it's important, even like with our more elective cases, that he walks regularly and has a multimodal pain regimen, as well as all of the other components of the ERAS principles. After a diverticulitis flare, everyone should receive a colonoscopy 6 to 8 weeks later to rule out any concurrent malignancy.
Perfect. So the post-flare colonoscopy is very important. Remember that perforation of a cancer could have been the inciting factor to what seemed initially like simple diverticulitis. And just as an aside, diverticulitis is also definitely not an easy or simple disease for patients to have. Each episode can lead to significant financial and emotional burden with hospitalization, missed work, and other things. Elective sigmoidectomy can be considered for patients with recurrent complicated diverticulitis, fistula, stricture, immunocompromised patients to reduce the likelihood of future flares. So that impact on the quality of life is important to consider, not just the number of episodes they have alone. All right, Mr. C is recovering slowly after his Hartmann's. Fast forward to post-op day 3, the nurse calls you because the ostomy looks dark and there's been minimal ostomy output for 24 hours. What do you do?
I've definitely gotten this call before. So I would go to the bedside and assess the stoma. A black stoma indicates possible mucosal necrosis of that stoma, and in the worst case scenario, mucosal ischemia that extends beneath the fascia into the intra-abdominal colon. This is where the test tube test can come in handy. This is where you insert a clear plastic test tube or a syringe barrel into the stoma lumen. The goal here is really to visualize that mucosa that's below the skin level to see if the ischemia is spreading into the intra-abdominal colon. If the mucosa looks pink and it's viable below the fascia, you may be just dealing with a superficial ischemia. But if it's dusky or black below that fascial level, that's full thickness ischemia and that's a surgical emergency.
So in this case, the mucosa is black and non-viable below the fascia. And unfortunately, there's no bleeding even when you gently scratch it. Labs show the leukocytosis and a rising lactate. What are you going to do next?
Yeah, so unfortunately for Mr. C, this is a surgical emergency for his ischemic stoma. Management includes taking the patient back to the OR for resection of any necrotic bowel and creation of a new end colostomy at a different site. Postoperatively, you'll want to provide broad-spectrum antibiotics, perform serial abdominal exams, and closely monitor that stoma.
Excellent. So there's a lot of things that can make a stoma look less than ideal, such as stomal retraction, venous congestion, but you certainly don't want to miss a necrotic stoma. That is an urgent surgical intervention. Okay, so we covered a lot here. Colon surgery is about thinking longitudinally, diagnosing correctly, operating thoughtfully, and managing complications early.
Thank you for listening. This is just one episode in the series entitled The EPA Playbook, where we delve into each of the EPAs that are outlined by the American Board of Surgery. You can find more information about the EPA descriptions and the specific competencies for each topic on the ABS website. Hope you can join us for the next episode, and as always, dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.